We've got a slide, I think, that actually tells us that, just in case we haven't got the message yet. A mirror, as you've all been seeing, is something that reflects light in a way that, you know, it preserves much of the original quality of what you're looking at, even after you've looked at it with a mirror. And nowadays, you know, a mirror is usually made of glass, and it's usually a plain mirror, a flat mirror, like these ones that we've been using tonight. But of course, some mirrors can have curved surfaces, and when you've got those, then you get either a bigger or a smaller image or a distorted image, a bit like those that you see at fun fairs, yeah? Okay, where you look smaller or fatter or thinner than usual. So, you know, we've got a picture here of what you look like with some of those distorting mirrors. And if you've ever been to a fun fair, it's a bit weird when you go through those kind of ones. Yeah. Yeah. One of the most famous Hall of Mirrors is at the Palace of Versailles in France. Some of you might have seen that one. This was a huge room built for Louis XIV, the French king, in the late 17th century. And in that room, there's more than 17 of these sort of like mirror arches. You've got the windows and then they've put the mirrors in there. So it seems even bigger and longer than it actually is because there are all the mirrors there. It's a huge room. It's 73 metres long by 10.5 metres by just over 12 metres. So it is a really big room. And mirrors at that time were really expensive to make. These ones were made in Venice. They were sort of like the capital of making mirrors. And so, you know, it's become a very famous room. It's where they signed the Treaty of Versailles. That officially ended World War I in 1919. They actually did all that signing with all the dignitaries and politicians in the Hall of Mirrors. Mirrors have often in stories and that, they've got special powers, haven't they? So when I talked about the theme of mirrors, Eileen said about the one in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Yeah, the wicked queen looks into this magic mirror and she says, what does she say? Mirror, mirror on the wall, who is the fairest of them all? And of course, up till then, it's always been her, hasn't it? But then one day this mirror says that it's Snow White, who's fairer than, you know, the fairest of them all, and so she plots to kill Snow White, you know. There's also a magic mirror in Alice Through the Looking Glass, yeah? The sequel to Alice in Wonderland, and Alice enters this fantastical world by jumping through a mirror into the world that she can see beyond the looking glass. So, you know, mirrors are often featured in stories and things like that. But mostly nowadays, you know, we use mirrors for personal grooming, if you're putting your makeup on or you're getting shaved or whatever to make sure you don't cut yourself. Or they're just there for decorations in architecture. Or sometimes we have them in things like cameras, scientific apparatus like telescopes, lasers, all those kind of things use mirrors. So mirrors are really quite useful. And usually they're designed for visible light, you know, light that we can see, but sometimes you use them for electromagnetic radiation, light that we can't see. But in Bible days, mirrors, they weren't made of glass, and obviously because of that, they weren't as precise or effective as mirrors that we use nowadays. First mirrors were most likely just pools of water, perhaps collected in some kind of earthen jar so that you could see yourself. You might know the story of Narcissus, the legend of Narcissus, right? He was this Greek youth, apparently, who saw his reflection in a pool of water, and he fell in love with what he saw in this pool of water. He didn't realise it was an image, you know, he fell in love. It's quite a risky image, yeah, but he's covered up. Yeah, he's covered up. He is covered up with his vital parts, but there he is staring at himself, thinking how wonderful he is. You can move on now. Now you've seen him. And that's where we get the word from. That's where we get the word from, being narcissistic, being obsessed with yourself, you know, because he looked in this mirror and he liked what he saw in this mirror so much that he refused to move away from the mirror and he just, you know, pined to death effectively. Well, lovely Greek story, as they often are, you know. The earliest manufactured mirrors were usually made of a polished stone, such as obsidian. That's a naturally occurring volcanic stone that's reflective. And in Bible times, mirrors were probably made from polished metals. So in the Old Testament, in Exodus, we read that the basin and the basin stand that were used in the tabernacle, they were made from the bronze mirrors of the women who served at the entrance to the tent of meeting. In Job 37, it talks about mirrors that were made of cast bronze. So obviously, you know, if you're looking into a bronze mirror, you can see some kind of reflection, can't you? But it's not really as clear as it is if you looked in a glass mirror nowadays. And perhaps, you know, it's because their mirrors weren't like ours that Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13, now we see only a reflection, as in a mirror, then we shall see face to face. No matter how good a mirror is, what we're seeing is always a reflection of the real thing. It's not the real thing itself. And in 1 Corinthians 13, Paul is talking to the church in Corinth about the most important thing in the Christian life, and he says that that's love. He says, even if we've got all kinds of spiritual gifts, and he's been talking about those in the previous chapter, we can prophesy or do tremendous miracles, or we give everything we've got to help the poor. If we don't have love, we can do nothing, and we have nothing of real value, and we are nothing. And he goes on in these verses to describe what love's like. He says, love is patient, love is kind. It does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud. It does not dishonor others, it's not self-seeking. It's not easily angered, it keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, and always perseveres. And he tells us then that the one reason that love's so important is because it's eternal. All these other things he's been teaching about, prophecies and speaking in tongues and having great knowledge, all of those, he says, one day will stop. But love will never fail and will never stop. And he tells us at the end of the chapter that it's the one thing we need in this life and in the life to come. Because it's got to be the one thing that defines a Christian. We've been looking in our Bible studies and John says, God is love. So love's got to be the characteristic feature of anyone who claims to love God and to follow him. Anyone who loves their brother and sister lives in the light, John says. Jesus gave his disciples a new command to love one another. And so in the middle of this chapter all about love, Paul goes on to say, love never fails. But where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when completeness comes, what is in part disappears. When I was a child, I talked like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put the ways of childhood behind me. For now we see only a reflection, as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I'm fully known. Now Paul obviously values spiritual gifts. He's teaching in 1 Corinthians 12 and 14 about them. And he says that, you know, Christians should earnestly seek these gifts. Seek gifts that can build up the church. It's clear, though, that we need those gifts now, not in the future. Because now, at the moment, we're in this state of imperfection. It's not complete. We don't know everything. But when we know God, in the sense of being with him, then we'll see him, and we won't need those things. John makes a similar point in his letter in chapter 3, because he says, now we're children of God, and what we will be has not yet been made known. But we know that when Christ appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. So, in this life now, our understanding of God is indirect and incomplete. And he uses two analogies, childhood and a mirror. In using the analogy of childhood, he's not suggesting that, you know, at the moment we're all childish or immature, but he's saying there are things that we don't know as children that we understand as we grow up, and it's going to be the same for us as Christians. And the analogy of the mirror implies that our visibility of Christ, what we can see and understand of Christ now, is indirect or incomplete. He's comparing the nature of looking in a mirror to the relationship that we will enjoy with Jesus when we see him face to face. Because it's not as clear, the reflection that you can see, as when you're actually with somebody face to face. Now, he says that that's an enigma. a bit of a riddle. Now, an enigma is a puzzling or inexplicable occurrence or situation. And I'm sure you've all done kind of riddles at kind of Christmas times. You get them in crackers, don't you? So I've got some riddles for you, okay, to do. So this first riddle says, what is greater than God, more evil than the devil? The poor have it, the rich need it, and if you eat it, you'll die. Okay, and the answer? Nothing, yeah? Because nothing's greater than God, nothing's more evil than the devil, the poor have nothing, the rich need nothing, and if you eat nothing, then you'll die. Okay, so that's a riddle. Next one. Okay. What has 88 keys but can't open a single door? Yeah, a piano? Yeah, this bit isn't a quiz, you know, we're not doing this in teams anymore. Okay, another one then. You draw a line without touching it, how do you make the line longer? You can't touch it. Okay, well this, yeah, you draw a shorter line next to it, and so the line that's there is longer. And the last one, okay, this is a bit longer, this one. It says the Smith family is a very wealthy family that lives in a big circular home. One morning, Mr. Smith woke up and saw a strawberry jam stain on his new carpet. He figured out that everyone who was there that morning had a jam sandwich. But by reading the following excuses, you've got to work out who spilled the jam. So Billy Smith says he was outside playing basketball. The maid says I was dusting the corners of the house. And the chef says I was starting to make lunch for later. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You're very good at riddles. Yeah, the maid's lying because they lived in a round house, a circular house, so she can't have been dusting the corners. Okay? So riddles, when you solve a riddle or an enigma, you've got to think a little bit outside the box. Usually there's a double meaning in a riddle, or you've got to look at the puzzle in a slightly different way. And Paul says that everything that we can see and know and experience in this life is a little bit like a riddle, or it's like looking in a mirror. You know, he says, God says of Moses in the Old Testament, with him I speak face to face clearly and not in riddles. He sees the form of the Lord. And most of us perhaps feel that we don't see the whole picture now. We don't understand everything of God. Sometimes we can't even fully understand ourselves. You know, our knowledge is limited. We see actions, we don't always see the motives behind the actions of other people. We don't really know what's going on behind the scenes. We certainly don't know what's going on in world politics or, you know, things like that. And Matthew Henry, in his commentary on these verses, says, all things are dark and confused now compared to what they will be hereafter. They can only be seen as by the reflection in a mirror or in the description of a riddle. But hereafter, our knowledge will be free from all obscurity and error. It is the light of heaven only that will remove all clouds and darkness that hide the face of God from us. And Barnes says of the idea of an enigma or a riddle, little is known, much is left to conjecture or debate. A very accurate account of most of that which passes for knowledge. Compared with heaven, our knowledge here much resembles the obscure intimations in an enigma compared with clear statements and manifest truth. There's always that sense of you don't quite know everything, you wish you did. And in these verses, Paul says there's a vast difference between now and not yet. And that's what we live with every day, isn't it? Now we're children of God, John says. That's already our status. If we've accepted Jesus as our Saviour, he's given us the right to become children of God. John says that in his Gospel. We're children born not of natural descent or of human decision or a husband's will, but born of God. If we haven't already become children of God, we can do that right now by asking Christ to forgive us our sins and by accepting that when he died for us on the cross, that's all we need to be made right with God. But at the same time, what we will be has not yet been made known. There's so much more to be revealed. We're only seeing that reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now we know in part, then we shall know fully, even as we're fully known. Now, we might feel there's so much that we don't yet know. But one day we will. One day, when the time is fully right, God will open up our eyes and show us everything that he wants us to see. Psalm 139 tells us that God already knows everything about us. In the psalm it says, "You've searched me, Lord, you know me. You know when I sit, you know when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You're familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you know it completely. You hem me in behind and before, and you lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain." But we can take comfort in the fact that God knows us through and through, and he loves us completely. And we can be encouraged, because one day perfection will come, and we too are going to be changed then. You know, in a flash, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet, it says in Corinthians, "For the trumpet will sound, the dead will be raised imperishable, and we'll be changed. For the perishable must clothe itself with the imperishable, and the mortal with immortality. And when the perishable has been clothed with the imperishable, and the mortal with immortality, then the saying that is written will come true. Death has been swallowed up in victory." Now we might see things through a glass darkly, it says in one of the old versions of 1 Corinthians 13. But the time's coming when we are going to be part of that bride who's beautifully dressed to meet her husband, and God's dwelling place will be among us. It says in Revelation 21, "They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He'll wipe away every tear from their eyes. There'll be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain, for the old order of things has passed away." And in verse 5 of that chapter, John goes on to say, "He who was seated on the throne said, I'm making everything new." I don't know about you, but I can't wait to be able to know fully and to be seen and to be with Jesus like that.